At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
In which central bankers basically say, you know what? We are doing all we can. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, I do believe the 19th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The watchwords of this program so far this week have been monetary policy, interest rates, and how the Federal Reserve uses them to manage this economy. We did an explainer on Tuesday, the Fed's Economic Policy Toolkit, set to music featuring, figuratively, Chair Jay Powell on guitar. You should check it out, marketplace.org. There was the interest rate decision yesterday featuring Chair Jay Powell, actually talking about the way the Fed does what it does. Today, it's the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and its downgrade of its global growth forecast this morning to its lowest level since 2009. I'm going to let that sink in for a second. There is the trade war, yes, but also there is this quote from the OECD's chief economist: do not rely on monetary policy to do the job alone. The head of the European Central Bank says the same thing. Jay Powell says a version of it, because fundamentally, central banks, for all their power, cannot do it all. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on here.
To try and spark some economic growth, central banks from the U.S. to Europe to China have been pulling out every tool in their toolbox of monetary policy. That's manipulating the money supply and interest rates, which are now negative in some places, and still, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
Central banks are wrestling with the fact that they have done everything they could, more than they ever thought they should, and growth is at best anemic. And the threat of recession is very real.
So they're kind of punting to the politicians and saying, now you need to use your tools, fiscal policy, to stimulate growth, which generally means cutting taxes and boosting spending. But not just any kind of spending, says Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute.
To invest more money, building new real estate, high-speed internet, education, research and development.
This kind of spending stimulates productivity and future economic growth. Here in the U.S., we've already done a version of fiscal stimulus, the massive 2017 tax cuts. Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum says that's led to soaring debt and deficits. He says we should be investing in things like roads and bridges, but bitter partisanship has left Congress in a state of fiscal paralysis.
The poster child for this is the absolute agreement that we need an infrastructure program and absolutely no ability to get it done.
In addition to more growth-friendly fiscal policy, central bankers and the OECD also want less confrontational, more growth-friendly trade policy to help recharge the global economy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This has been, for a very long time, the past 3 years aside, a really low interest rate economy. And even when the Fed raised rates, by the way, it was still a low interest rate economy. What that has meant, among other things, is that keeping your money in something like a savings account almost hasn't been worth it. Bankrate.com says the average interest rate for a savings account right now is a 0.1% a year. So with the Fed having just cut rates for the second meeting in a row, and with the reality that nothing in this or any economy happens in isolation, now what? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
When interest rates go down, banks start paying less to depositors almost immediately, says Mayra Rodriguez-Valladares at MRV Associates. But she says banks don't move as quickly to lend out money at lower rates.
So I guarantee you that right now, if somebody goes in to borrow money and says, oh, well, the Fed just lowered rates, The bank is not going to say, oh, you're right, let me lower your rate.
Very interesting, she says, because when the Fed decides to raise rates, quite the opposite is true for banks.
If interest rates go up, they won't move quickly to raise the rate for depositors, but they'll move quickly to raise the rate for any new borrowers.
Savers haven't earned much since the financial crisis drove interest rates to historic lows. But there are many online savings accounts with interest rates that rose to above 2%, like Ally Bank's savings account and Goldman Sachs' Marcus. Greg McBride at Bankrate says those accounts are more sensitive when rates fall.
You benefited on the way up, and you're going to give a little bit of that back on the way down.
Banks will eventually start charging less for business loans. After all, that's why the Fed cuts rates to begin with. Kent Belasco runs the commercial banking program at Marquette University. He says some banks will have to turn to individuals again to make up for lost revenue.
That's when you start to get into fee income or other services that the banks are offering to hopefully make up for it.
If rates stay low and more fees start popping up, Belasco says banks should start worrying because customers will shop around. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today up a little bit early on, then a long, slow slide to a mixed close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Trade talks picked up today, U.S.-China trade talks, to be clear. It's been a long 18 months, as you know, of tariffs lying back and forth. The next round of which, by the way, is set for October 15th. Fresh American taxes on another $250 billion worth of stuff that we import from China. We talk a whole lot on this program about what the trade war is doing to consumers here, because we are paying the Trump tariffs. Chinese consumers, though, what's up with them? Marketplace's Jennifer Pak is in Shanghai.
On the streets of Shanghai, some consumers complain China's retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods are hurting. Many of the levies target American food products, things like pecans from the state of Georgia. Tariffs on these have increased 40% since last year. Liu Hongde, who is passing out flyers to a busy lunchtime crowd, says he loves the Georgia pecans, but doesn't buy them as often since the price went up. Even so,
sometimes when I really want to have some and I can't control myself, I'll just buy the nuts.
He's more worried about the cost of basic foods, and that's affected by factors other than tariffs. Fruit and pork prices, for example, have seen double-digit increases because of bad weather and African swine fever.
I hesitate a lot when I buy things now.
And most Chinese consumers don't feel the effects of tariffs on things like American beef, cherries, and whiskey, because they are premium products. The few who can afford them, like e-commerce worker Sun Quan, are less cost-conscious. He says he's just had a wage increase. And besides, if the tariffs push prices too high, there are other options.
If you don't want to buy from the U.S., you can import from Australia. There's not much difference, really.
Others, like Zhang Jiayao in advertising, says he wouldn't mind switching to Chinese brands.
When I was young, I thought imported goods were better. Now I believe our Chinese products are also good.
And the tariffs aren't just affecting products. The current trade tensions sometimes make things harder for anyone working on U.S.-China projects. Elaine Hu studied at UCLA, then returned to China to work in film.
There are a lot less film, and you can do a lot of co-productions. If you use an American crew, sometimes I have a problem.
The trade tensions are a censored topic here, so it's sometimes hard to know what people really feel about the tariffs. This retired government worker worries about official retaliation and would only give her surname Chen. When we asked what brands she buys, this was her response.
We buy Chinese products. We're Chinese, remember that.
Although when it comes to her cell phone,
it's an iPhone.
In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The big United Nations Climate Change Summit is going to be here this weekend. New York technically runs through Monday. The problem is, of course, that conferences and reports and summits are great, but climate change, the actual thing, is already here. More extreme weather, bigger wildfires, higher sea levels as well. Adapting to all that is a huge global challenge, a technical one too. Now, who do we know who's always ready to take on big challenges, Well, how about Silicon Valley, which, as it happens, is dealing with global warming right in its own backyard? Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, went to find out what big tech is doing about it.
Silicon Valley is not just a metaphor for the tech industry. It's a real place. Cities and businesses and people surrounded by a rising sea and at risk from increasingly extreme weather. And I wanted to know what the industry is doing to adapt and maybe help the rest of us too. So we started here. This is a bicycle path along the Stevens Creek Trail. It runs through Mountain View, California, where Google is located, and it connects to a whole system of trails that covers much of Silicon Valley. At rush hour on a weekday, it's teeming with tech commuters, people walking, running, scooting, and riding their bikes.
She has foldable bikes.
I have two. I have two purple bikes.
She has, yes, mostly purple.
That is Pat Showalter and Deb Headington. We asked them to meet us here to basically show me how the tech industry, the community, and climate change come together every day. Showalter is the former mayor of Mountain View and a civil engineer.
This is a steelhead stream.
Steelhead trout. Yep.
They have been coming here for thousands of years.
Meanwhile, Deb Henningsen, the one with the purple bike and the purple hair, for what it's worth, she has been biking to her job at Google on this trail every day for the past 17 years, alongside lots of other tech workers.
Intuit employees, Microsoft employees, and Google employees all use the trail. The Samsung campus that's over here is right next to the trail. Yeah, so there are a bunch.
And you can see impacts of climate change all along this trail. Showalter showed me deep cliffs that drop into the creek because the sides of the bank have collapsed from cycles of drought and heavy rain. And in the ravine are trunks of really big trees that fell over during landslides.
Well, when you have the more droughts, the trees are stressed, the banks dry in, they're more friable, it's easier to erode them, the trees fall in. Stevens Creek Trail is really kind of a little, like a little microcosm of climate change.
And it's not just drought that will be a problem here. It's more heat waves, wildfires, storms, and sea level rise.
The Bay Area, you know, we have the central feature being the San Francisco Bay, and we have development that rings the bay.
Mike Milkey is with the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a trade association that includes most big tech companies.
We have 9 counties, 101 cities, over 7 million people. We have a lot at stake from sea level rise.
The campuses of Facebook, Intel, Cisco, Google are all basically at sea level. Scientists call this region a bathtub. As the water level gets higher, it spills over the sides into the communities around it. Back on the trail, Deb Henningsen says she thinks tech companies know about the risks to their infrastructure and the community. Speaking for herself and not Google, she says that as they try to adapt to the climate change that's coming, these companies are also cleaning up the mess that Silicon Valley left behind from the 1960s to the 80s, when the Valley was actually manufacturing computer chips and semiconductors using actual silicon. And there is a lot of pollution left over. In fact, Santa Clara County, the heart of the Valley, has more Superfund cleanup sites than any county in the U.S.
The companies that are here, especially the companies that are large landowners, they recognize the mistakes of past technology companies and are dealing with it in a lot of ways. And I think the current generation of tech companies is all too aware of that history and wants to do better, a better kind of tech company.
I asked Henningsen if maybe the biggest tech companies should get together with governments and launch something like a space program for climate.
I think that there are many employees inside tech companies that would like to do more with their individual technology projects and apply them to climate change. And I think you will start to see more of that becoming public.
But she says maybe one barrier is that climate change isn't just a concrete challenge that you can solve with the right code.
Unlike the space program, there is no cardinal goal. There is no, we're going to get to the moon in 10 years. And you know, tech companies love goals and they love moonshots, right? They love unachievable goals, but it usually is a concrete goal, you know? That's the hard thing about climate change.
So far, the big tech companies are mostly tackling climate change with their nonprofit divisions and by making their own operations more sustainable. But it's not part of the core business for most of them. In Silicon Valley, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Molly and Marketplace Tech have been doing a whole week of coverage about what Silicon Valley is and is not doing about climate change. You can find all of it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
They sold rice for a while. They tried to get into taxi cabs.
Then they did esports. But first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 52 points today, a 10%, 27,094. The NASDAQ was essentially unchanged, 8182. S&P 500 the same, 3,006 there. U.S. Steel hammered down more than 11% today after cutting its profit forecast. The company recently laid off a bunch of workers in Michigan. U.S. steel company Nucor off 0.3%. Steel Dynamics, though, advanced about 0.4%. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a Democratic proposal today to cut prescription drug prices. So, into Wall Street's drug cabinet we go. Pfizer popped up nearly 0.3%. GlaxoSmithKline delivered nearly 0.2%. Today, bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note, as that happens, down to 1.78%. You're listening to Marketplace. You count on Marketplace to help you understand how the economy works and the way it affects our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we count on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Think of it as an investment in your lifelong education. Any donation helps, and if you give today, you'll help unlock a $50,000 match from the Candida Fund. So please, become a Marketplace investor at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This next story brought to you by that little something extra you have to pay when you buy something. In most states, you go to the store, you buy a pack of gum, or you go to a dealership to buy a car, you pay sales tax. For a long time, though, like 26 years, if you bought something online from a company in another state, no tax due. The Supreme Court said so. But then in 2018, in a case called South Dakota v. Wayfair, deep into the days of the internet economy, the court changed its mind and said out-of-state online taxation was okay. And in the year or so since that ruling, states, knowing a good source of revenue when they see it, have passed laws doing just that. Laws that senators from a couple of states without sales tax now want to stop. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Kate Davidson explains.
To understand how these laws work, step into this Portland warehouse and meet Dave Stainsby.
We're kind of checking out the shelves, looking to see what we have in stock right now.
Stainsby runs e-commerce for Made in Oregon, which sells all kinds of distinctly Oregon products, pottery, Pendleton blankets, and this very popular hat.
It's a trucker hat. It's got a patch that says Oregon is above California. There's a lot of Oregonians that just chuckle and love that thing.
As I said, distinctly Oregon. Now, another distinct thing about Oregon is it has no sales tax of its own. So this year, it's been a huge change for Made in Oregon to have to collect tax for online sales in about a dozen other states.
Colorado, Georgia, Illinois, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota.
Stainsby says it's a headache. He estimates it will cost nearly $40,000 in staff time and software to comply with the tax rules of dozens of states. And companies around the country are confronting the same situation. Diane Yetter is the founder of the Sales Tax Institute in Chicago.
So sales tax before the Supreme Court decision last year was based on where a company maintained physical presence. And so the easy way to think about that is where did you have a store, an office, a manufacturing plant, a warehouse?
But in what's known as the Wayfair case, the court looked at the explosion of online shopping and the erosion of sales tax revenue. It ruled that companies can also establish an economic presence in a state, making them responsible for collecting sales tax. That was good news to Washington State Representative Gail Tarleton.
The Wayfair decision is one of those rare things that happen where we say everyone has to play by the same set of rules. If you're an online customer, it's the same as walking into a storefront.
Today, almost every state, including Washington, requires online businesses to collect sales tax once retail sales pass a certain threshold, say $100,000. Tarleton says that money matters in Washington, which has no income tax and relies heavily on sales taxes to fund services.
We're paying for health care. We're paying for education. We're paying for affordable housing and everything that our communities need to thrive.
But the U.S. senators from Oregon and New Hampshire, where there is no sales tax, are worried about how businesses are faring in this post-Wayfair world. They've introduced legislation to prevent remote sellers from having to collect sales tax until 2021 to give them more time to prepare. And Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley says the measure would exempt small businesses altogether.
This bill will say that small businesses across the nation, those that have less than $10 million in sales, do not have to collect sales taxes for the 10,000 taxing jurisdictions across the country.
He says big businesses can handle the complexities of sales tax compliance.
They have the infrastructure to be able to do this, and that's not such a burden. But to a small business, it's an enormous burden.
There are signs some states may be sympathetic to that argument. A handful have already changed the thresholds they use to determine which remote companies should collect sales tax, recognizing too many small businesses were affected. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Adapt or die. Right? I mean, it sounds harsh, but there is a certain amount of Darwinism in business. Got to stay a step ahead of the competition. So from time to time on this program, we tell you about companies making hard left turns or right turns. Take your pick. YouTube started out as a video-based dating service. It's true. Shopify, the big e-commerce company, online snowboard equipment in its early days. This next pivot that Marketplace's Andy Euler is about to tell you about was even more unusual. Oil and gas exploration to competitive video gaming. Here you go.
If you're wondering how in the world a company gets all the way from fracking to Fortnite, well, it started with a phone call. In the summer of 2018, Black Ridge Oil and Gas CEO Ken DeCubelis was chatting with one of his company's largest investors.
And he said, "Ken, what do you know about esports?" And I chuckled and I said, "Well, I can tell you my 11-year-old son is playing Fortnite all the time, and when he's not, he's on YouTube watching other people play Fortnite, or he's on Twitch watching this guy Ninja play Fortnite."
The investor on the phone, a guy named Lyle Berman, was pitching a company called Allied Esports, which puts together and broadcasts video game tournaments. Allied was part of the same company as World Poker Tour, which Berman also funded 17 years ago. It turns out Berman's a pretty famous poker player. He's in the Poker Hall of Fame. He told DeCubelis that Black Ridge Acquisition Corp., an investment company that went public in 2017, should ditch oil and gas and instead acquire the esports company, along with the poker company, for a cool $150 million.
We weren't out looking for esports opportunities, but you know, we ended up going full steam ahead with the pivot to esports.
The world of competitive video gaming suddenly just looked like a better investment than the volatile energy industry, which was losing its luster. But to make the pivot, Black Ridge had to sell the idea to its investors.
You know, when we were going on the road explaining this to shareholders, the very first question was, "Wait a minute, when you came here before your October 2017 IPO, you were selling an oil and gas thesis. What is this all about?"
DeCubelis isn't concerned that his expertise is energy. He says esports is such a young industry that there are no real experts there. Joanne Hyland co-authored a book called Pivot, How Top Entrepreneurs Adapt and Change Course to Find Ultimate Success. She says there are a few things a business needs to understand when trying to make a hard left turn.
We would want to know that they have a good market understanding of these new markets that they would want to go into. Because it's very difficult to go from, for example, oil and gas all the way over to esports without having some fundamental capabilities to make it happen.
A big pivot, it's been done many times. Just look at video game company Nintendo. It started out as a Japanese playing card manufacturer in the 1890s. After some mild success, the company was struggling to stay afloat, tried to get into a bunch of other industries that ended up going nowhere.
They sold rice for a while. They tried to get into taxi cabs. They even had something called love hotels, which are hotels that rent by the hour, You can fill in the rest there yourself.
That's Jeff Ryan. He's author of the book Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. He says when the company started manufacturing video games in the 1970s, it still had contacts in the toy industry. So Nintendo's pivot was a little less out of left field than moving from oil and gas to esports.
Nintendo never did what Blackridge seems to do, which is to discard their whole hand of poker and pick five new cards.
That new hand, esports, is growing rapidly. Technology consulting firm Activate says already more than 250 million people watch esports around the world. And Goldman Sachs says more people watch other people play video games than tune in for Major League Baseball. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, life comes at you fast, department. The National Rifle Association's Twitter account, which has about 780,000 or so followers, tweeted out a picture of Democratic presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke this morning with the caption, AR-15 Salesman of the Month, prompted, of course, by O'Rourke saying in the wake of the shootings in El Paso last month, hell yes, we are going to take your AR-15s. One imagines whoever's running the NRA's Twitter feed hadn't seen the Associated Press story this morning in which the CEO of Colt, which makes the AR-15, said the company is going to suspend production of rifles for the civilian market, including the aforementioned AR-15. The company remains committed to the Second Amendment, he said. It's adapting to consumer demand. All right, that's all we got. The Dow Industrials down 52 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ basically unchanged. S&P 500 unchanged as well. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.